Right, good evening, everyone. Yesterday, and this is the topic I picked for tonight. I thought about yesterday, when we have, so there's the sitting group at home, and as I was preparing the room yesterday, I took care of various things as we do in retreats, and I took the incense bowl and I cleaned the little bits and took them out and made really kind of nicely the ashes really just neatly organized. I pour the water into this little bowl to the filled it really to the very end. I changed the candle, and I usually use this little round candle and it doesn't work very well. So I looked for something else and I picked another thing and I put it. I checked the flowers. And I did all that after I had organized all the cushions. And that really kind of triggered a whole reflection about these various items. Why are we doing this? And why is that relevant? Why the water? Why the incense? Why and how? What does it evoke to me to do that? And that really kind of triggered a whole meditation, basically, about these various items, these various offerings that we do. And the first thing that I wanted to share with you is that it allowed me to do that, allowed me to remember what I was actually about to do. It's like already put my mind into motion or into stillness. It was really like preparing. I was really getting prepared. And as I was really getting prepared, I was already doing it by really kind of mindfully just doing the making the ashes really neat in the incense bowl and all that, and trying to make the whole thing nice. And I do that several times a week, because in all these institutions where I go, I always arrive in a room and I need to set up the room, and I'm quite always quite meticulous about how to position the cushions, because I like it. I really kind of like that. I really feel that it gives, by giving a certain form, it really allows us to really make it easier to just arrive in that space and cultivate the qualities that we want to cultivate. It's really like the form is, the container is at the same time is a manifestation of what is being expressed or what is being cultivated. So I was looking at these various items, and I was kind of trying to relate to, or he, I was trying to hear what it was telling me, or what it was evoking for me. Just like the incense, burning the incense, it's in traditionally, I always imagined, I don't know if it's true, but I always imagined that in monasteries they didn't have a watch, and so that was the timer. I don't know if that is true or not, but I was it's about, a stick of incense, well, at least what we're using is about 30 minutes, so that makes sense that it kind of it was a I don't know if Roshi has a knowledge about that, but it's like this has always been my thing. But at the same time, as always, it can also be, it can be taken as something symbolic. Or if we just contemplate kind of the stick of incense just moving from solid to to ashes, what does it trigger? What it triggered in me is that I was thinking of all these philosophical questionings of the ancient Greek about identity, the question of identity, this thing going from one state to the other. So are the ashes still a stick of incense or not? Has the stick of incense totally disappeared? What is a stick of incense? If it disappears by it, in does it change in nature? But it's symbolic because it can be taken as something symbolic because it's really what we do with in our sitting, deconstructing our notions, the various notions that we have of ourselves, of reality, of others. I guess traditionally it's incense is a symbol of the fragrance of pure moral conduct. And this is interesting that it's something that we keep doing, that we, in ceremonies, this is the thing that we do the most. Like we bow and we offer incense. We don't offer flowers, we offer flowers once, but then we keep offering incense. And again, it's like if that is a kind of a symbol of moral conduct or just conduct or ethical conduct, it's like linking that idea with the gesture means that we do it automatically, mindlessly, or we just really kind of fully mean it. And indeed, it's like I always have in mind when I think about bowing and offering incense to the Buddha, I'm always thinking of Michel Roshi and how he really, really just like put all his heart into it. And he was really explaining to me how he was really watching the Buddha and just like really, just really, really fully present. Really remembering ourselves that this, we're really offering that to the Buddha. We really fully surrender to what we're doing. Oh God, there's so many ways to say it. So the candle. It was really nice to have a proper candle yesterday, that because these tiny ones, they have this tiny, 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 tiny little light. And it's actually really nice to have a nice flame. I was thinking as it came up in my sitting right now, how also this whole notion of light and darkness appears in the sutra that we sing, Identity of Relative and Absolute. Obviously, light allows us to see things, so that also can be taken as a symbol of wisdom, our ability to distinguish things, move away from the darkness of ignorance. What kind of things do we, yeah, we sing a lot of things about dispel the darkness of, yeah, dispel the darkness of ignorance in one of our chants, or dedication and services. At home, I have a tiny, tiny, tiny bowl for the water. So I need to be very meticulous to have the proper jar to put the water in it so that it doesn't spill everywhere. And it because it's so tiny from one week to the other, it evaporates actually. So it needs to be, I should probably do it every day, I don't know, but I do it once a week. And I like that image of the water takes the shape of its container. What is our shape? What is the shape of our container? What is the water that we put in? And it symbolizes, obviously, as we leave it on the table, and if there's no earthquake or movements in the house, it stabilizes. As our mind stabilizes, we often take the, I often take the, I've heard that many times, meditation, an image of meditation, it's like this, as if we were a glass of water full of stuff, and it's just it, the particles goes into the bottom. So it allows us to, being still allows the thing, allows the calmness to arise. Allows us to see more clearly, to see clearly as the water is clear when we leave it, just resting. And then the flowers. It's always interesting in Noisy when we arrive in Noisy and we look for flowers, or in any retreats. It's like depending on the seasons, it's different. We never really know what we're going to find, what we're going to be able to use. It requires to be changed regularly because it fades, it wilts. So it, yeah, it's impermanent, fades away, it changes in colors and shape. So again, like we can really just really see it as a symbol of impermanence and transient nature of things. And it's beautiful. And I've never had that actually, that I realize I've never had that function, I think, as taking care of the altar in a retreat. Ever, but I know that those who are making bouquet are really, really just like trying to really make the most possible, most beautiful bouquet possible with whatever is available. So that notion of beauty and looking for just taking care of the altar and taking care of making it beautiful, even though it's transient, it changes, it's gonna fade away. So these couple of items that we put on the altar is can really, I mean, if we really pay attention to what is actually taking place, we could, it tells a whole story about the intentions that we're trying to cultivate, the qualities that we're trying to cultivate. It really shakes up our intentions. There's a teaching in, it can be taken as a teaching into impermanence, into this trigger an investigation about the nature of self, which is exactly what we do. But again, it's like any rituals. If we just do it automatically, mindlessly, not paying attention, it's just, you know, it's nothing. It's not a symbol of anything. It's just things that we do. But it might be worthwhile to look at it, to look at our relationship to these various items, to these various offerings, and how we handle them, and what it provokes, and in terms of thoughts, in terms of yeah, investigation. I was looking for a koan that would talk about offerings, and I found one from a koan collection called Collection of Stone and Sand, Shaseki Shu. That was a collection that was made in the 13th century by a Japanese monk called Muju Ichin. And there's the case 24, which I thought was was quite deep and amusing at the same time. It's called Reciting Sutras. A farmer requested a Tendai priest to recite sutras for his wife who had died. After the recitation was over, the farmer asked, "Do you think my wife will gain merit from this?" So the priest answered, "Not only your wife, but all sentient beings will benefit from the recitation of sutras." So the farmer says, "If you say all sentient beings will benefit, my wife may be very weak and others will take advantage of her, getting the benefit she should have. So please recite sutras just for her." The priest explained that it was the desire of a Buddhist to offer blessings and wish merit for every living beings. "This is a fine teaching," concluded the farmer, "but please make one exception. I have a neighbor who is rough and mean to me. Just exclude him from all sentient beings." It's pretty clear. We don't want to share the merits. I mean, he doesn't want to share the merits so that his wife gets all of it. It makes me think that, you know, this whole, it may be a little bit strange for us, and maybe we are kind of moving away from it, but this is worth investigating. You know, this whole notion of merits and offerings, We offer things, but what's the difference between an offering and a merit? And there's a, I think we, I mean, we in our lineage, I feel we, I mean, it's mentioned in the text, the merits and all that, but if we go back to the orthodox Buddhist thinking, you know, this, you accumulate merit in order to gain certain rank in the rebirth scheme so that ultimately you can reach nirvana. But yeah, I don't think none of us would offer, you know, incense thinking I'm gonna gain some merit for my afterlife or some, you know, gain some good deeds or something. But what I do find interesting in the koan is again this attempt from the priest to show an orientation that the practice is just is not just about ourselves. I mean, we can take it also as a koan investigating what's the difference, you know, how is your wife different from other all other beings? How is she not how is she not one with the rest? But there is a yeah, there's a clear indication and an invitation to just show this desperate farmer who lost his wife to broaden his perspective, broaden his compassion. So there's a and in the all the texts we I mean again going back to the four vows, just like the first line that we chant, an invitation to broader our practice, not just to us, but to all sentient beings or to all living beings or to all things. Orientation of the mind. It's very funny, the last line. Please make one exception. I have a neighbor who is rough and mean to me. Just exclude him from all those sentient beings. And it is hard. I mean, these days it would be very easy to, it is very easy to leave certain people outside of the realm of our prayers because really just too difficult. Too difficult to pray for them. So all that to say that we are surrounded in our practice by all kinds of small details that helps us to remember a number of very important part of the teachings. That's what was very obvious to me when I was looking at that. And if we really pay attention, that we can really trigger reflections and investigation about these various aspects of what we're trying to cultivate in our practice. And I find it really worthwhile to not think that, or like for me, for example, that on a Wednesday evening, that the practice starts when people arrive. It really starts, or the formal practice starts really before, as I prepare the room. It's that moment is also can be taken as a real moment of practice if I put my heart at it, and if I'm mindful to what I'm doing, and if I look at these small details with intently, I think that's what we say. Yeah, I think that's all I have to say for the moment. Not much more. So, floor is open to sharing and questions and whatever. Stories. Yeah, João.
Thank you. The koan you mentioned made me think of something I thought. Why do some Buddhists not care about animal rights, for instance? And I came up to se several reasons, one of which is people see Buddhism as like a savings account. We have certain merits and certain demerits, and if we do enough good things, we don't have to think about bad things. And I don't think that's a correct view of Buddhism. So every little action is completely, know, on its own, although it's interrelated, but and it's obviously good that we do good things, but that shouldn't excuse us from doing bad things. And the other reason I thought was also that, you know, people just don't make the don't have the good fortune of having seeds in their minds to recognize the value of all beings. Just the beings they want to value. This is my comment. Thank you.
Yeah, I. What you're saying, just like I would have one answer. It's like Eightfold Path. You know, the Eightfold Path is really embodies the whole path, and that includes action, or like a small version of it, which like really Bernie Glassman's, these three tenets of not knowing, bearing witness, and action. Yeah. But I think it's also worth investigating what it means by not doing anything. Or like, thinking, oh, these people are not engaged. I've always been very puzzled by this whole distinction. I was mentioning that to Debbie, I think, recently. Very puzzled about this whole supposed orthodox position with the Hinayana Theravada monks that are just, basically doing the practice for themselves, theoretically. And then the Mahayana, it's like us, you know. They are really welcoming and really just doing it for the whole world. But I remember going to Cambodia and going to places where monks were taking care of a school. And at the same time, we hear in that in Japan, in the Zen monasteries, that's not very lively anymore. And besides doing funerals, they don't do much in terms of for the community. So I'm a little bit cautious with that. And I've always say that I'm a little bit uncomfortable also with this notion of engaged Buddhism, as if there were a non-engaged Buddhism. I'm not really, if you follow the Eightfold Path, I really don't know what could a non-engaged Buddhism look like. I mean, it could look like as someone who has certain very strong ideas about what it should look like, and those people don't fit that project, and so that's non-engaged. But I think it's worth, you know, investigating what it means by, you know, doing good. What does it mean, and are we limiting ourselves? I mean, frankly, I go to these institutions these days, and recently I had very few people. And I'm like, I'm not, this is really, if I'm thinking in terms of numbers, my merits are not going very high. So, you know, am I not engaged? Am I fully engaged? You know, is saving one person, or who am I saving? Who am I serving? You know, it's really worth investigating. I have no answer to that.
Thank you, Joe, so much for talking about the altar, especially in what he. I've done the altar many times, and it's almost as if I'm in another world. Michelle Roshi is one person who talks a lot about devotion, and when I'm dealing with the things on the altar, I feel very much that I'm in a devotional practice without it having any particular form. I mean, what exactly is happening? I'm making sure that the altar is available and beautiful for the Sangha and correct, or at least things are in the right place for the teacher. So it brings everything together, and all of the different the candle. When you were talking, I saw a whole different group of candles that I've been through, and which re recipient the water is in. It's a very, very special moment. And picking the flowers, or when there aren't any flowers, leaves or something else to put on the altar, it's really a coming together for me of all the different participants in the retreat, the altar part, the setting up of the altar, and passing it on to the cleaning up of the sand in the recipient, and the flattening it out so that it's going to be tight enough to hold the incense stick. It's just as you were talking, I was there, and talk and telling. Since the last person I discussed it, that I transmitted it to was Freddie, and he was really into it too. There's something about the precision. I'm very haberdash. I'm generally flub being precise and keeping everything in its place and everything. And things are kind of messy, mushy in my world. So it's a moment when I really come together in the precision of where everything is, how it fits and everything. And I noticed as I was talking to him about it, he got all into using the tweezers to take the ends of the incense out and everything. There's something very, very special about it. The other thing you mentioned, I've been doing this in the last year or so, and it seems to me that last year maybe, every time we talked about all as being one with everybody, we always kind of put the present president of the United States outside of the category that we were being one with. He didn't quite fit in the group. And I've been thinking about that actually, seriously, even about him, because in circumstances where I've come across, and even in Zen environments, I come across somebody that I get stuck with. But there's a lot of rumination about, they said that, and does that mean that? And I should tell them that, and let's make sure that everybody knows their place and everything. I decided a couple of years ago to just, in a very childish or childlike way, just praying for them as a big, that sounds, it's not quite that much, send a positive vibe. And it is astounding how much it changes the relationship. I'm sure it changes probably my facial expression when I see the person, but it seems to do even more than that. The thing, the problem unravels seemingly miraculously. Let's put it that way. I'm sure maybe it's understandable psychologically, but it really, for me, it has been very effective. So I started doing it about the present president of the United States, and I see him very differently now. And I see my feelings for him, although this is the situation in the United States is really, really rocking me. I see my feelings about him very differently too. So for me, this has been a very positive practice. Just an opening or a cessation of hatred. Maybe that's a better way of saying it. Just stop hating this person for a minute. Stop hating the situation and let something else evolve, and it really changes in real life. I mean, what comes at what goes on after that, I guess. So thank you very much for all the things that you said.
Yeah, and thank you for bringing the word devotion. I really, the more I grow more and more fond of that word, devotion. And it's funny because I just always feel that c'est un gros mot in French. It's like it's not something that, I mean, if you try to get people interested in Zen, and if you start with devotional practices, they might run away. But because we are scared of devotional practice, I think. Oh, it's kind of scary. But there is something that, yes, as you explain, it's like it's such a there's so much in devotion. Like there's the joy of doing things. There's the doing it for others and doing it for the beauty of it, doing it because we're just doing it mindfully and it's beautiful to do it. It grows on us, and we just want to continue doing it, to continue doing it. And there is such a surrendering also in the devotional practices, or doing something with devotion. We really let go of something. There's something very soothing and relaxing, I find. Yeah. But I guess it's a bad word if we think of worshiping, and then it puts us in. Yeah. I really like that word. Yeah. I remember talking with Gena Roshi about the impression we had about the devotion that takes place in India, and how It's very powerful. It's very beautiful the way people are really just fully there and fully surrendering and
And
intent.
unashamedly, because it works in that culture. Michelle Roshi is the one that, when we were all on the screen for during COVID, talked a lot about devotion, and it sort of liberated. I love it, but it's true that in this context, it's not doesn't generally it's not a word that comes up, but he's quite open about it.
Yeah, but I guess what maybe makes it difficult is we really there's something to let go of and the doing it for others and if we stay in this precisely in that mode of I'm doing it for myself, the mo devotion cannot take place. Yeah. And that is quite a leap to do. Yeah, sure.
I've been to some events by Ananda Marga, which is a an organization that seeks to develop the mind or the heart and make service to the community. And they do, I did this, they call it kirtan, which is like a dance, a devotional, like mini dance, in which we are, I don't know, opening up. And then there's the meditation. And I liked it quite a lot, the kirtan. So I'm going there more times, but you know, they say everything is love. I'm not sure. What to say about that?
You're not
I'm
sure
not
that everything is love?
sure what to say about that. I don't know.
I mean, I always view all these things as various, how can I say? Various aspects of the practice that are being tackled, you know? Like there's one particular practice that emphasizes something or gives a certain perspective, you know? And it's wonderful to be able to just to investigate what needs to be investigated for you. You know, it's like using a practice that is really helping at the moment to develop, cultivate the thing that really needs to be addressed, deepened, you know, looked at. And it's very rich. I mean, the various we have a really an infinity in fact of practices at hand that really address more specifically certain aspects of the practice. And we can really use that. We can really just benefit from that and yeah. And probably where you feel there's resistance, or there is something that I'm not sure about that. That's a good indication that maybe there is something to deepen, if you want to. What are we resisting? Where is it not flowing?
Thanks.
What you just said, Sensei, I remember encountering that a lot in my brief experience in the with the Tibetan practice, which was where I began. That point of noticing what was, it could be notice what was triggered in a given situation, something that I would feel uncomfortable or triggered in some way. Looking at that as a, okay, there is, I should look at this. I could look at this. What's happening here? What is this about? You were talking about the all the different practices we have to address specific issues. And I remembered I've read recently, was reading a text about Iberian. It was talking about the in the Catholic context, the spirituality, the tradition of spirituality in the Iberian Peninsula, and how there is a some difference between the Portuguese and the Spanish tradition. And they were talking at some point specifically about the saints and all this tradition with the saints the Catholic spirituality has, which I don't know that much about. For me, it was always, I guess, much just very this very messy and confusing. We have all the, you have all these images and all these different people. But they were talking about it in this sense of, it's like each saint is addressing a particular issue, that can and bring back that to our own experience. It could be not feeling generous or feeling anger, whatever, and so and this tradition of saints as a means to, and for me this was surprising because I had never I had never encountered anything like this. And so also in what you were talking about reminded me of that, all these different tools, I guess, for addressing specific difficulties or obstacles that we might experience. Yeah. Just to share that detail. Thank you.
Yeah, and I'm thinking an equivalent of saints could be, the various bodhisattvas that we have also, that, and we can have more or less affinities with all the Buddha families. Yeah, Buddha families, and all this is again like seeing all these tools. Right now, I'm starting to think about the statue, the Buddha that should or the statue, or what should be at the in the new Zendo in Arles. And so It's kind of I've been looking at what's I've been asking around, and I've trying to think about, what could be the. So I spoke with Gen Roshi and said, "Oh yeah, I should, I mean, traditionally it's Manjushri and da da da," and then I thought Manjushri with the sword and all that, but like, why? Why not? There are others. There are also other figures, images, or symbols, statues that represent another aspect of the teachings. What does speak to us? What do we, how do we relate to these various statues and figures? It's very dynamic, actually. It can be very lively. It can really spark questions and I wasn't there at the study group, but I did read the text, and then I had a discussion with someone about the text, and it was very intriguing. This word that was used was called what was it? Imaginal, imaginal. That was the term that was used. Imaginal, and it made me think of how the our ability to respond to life situations is really a matter of imagination. And so what we try to embody, I feel, in this practice is our ability to be imaginative. Because there are no, to go back to Juan's comment about right and wrong actions, I mean, you don't see anywhere really what a right or wrong action is. I mean, just broad, very broad principles about not harming. But nothing very specific. There are rules. There are certain rules in the Vinaya, in the monastic rules, but this is something different. So there is this thing of responding with imagination to life's situations. All right, shall we maybe stop here, except if anyone else wants to add something? No. We're good. All right. Thank you for sharing and listening. Thank you.
I just quickly want to say that it's nice to see you all and thank you for your talk. It's rare that I can be here with you, so. And it made me think of a quote that says, how you do anything, you do everything. And I'm not really, I have been thinking about a little bit about that. So is that really true? But anyway, what I wanted to say is that practice and this kind of practice, like preparing an altar or the ashes and etc., really putting your full attention to something like that helps cultivate the attention with which we can then be in the world and be more attentive and more aware of how we act and respond. And so just wanted to add that and say hello. Thank you.